songs sung in riddles, words spoken in code, messages shared in the dark of the night, messages that the oppressor does not get to understand, has not earned the right to know. The songs of the Underground Railroad contain within them truth that those who hold others in bondage cannot see and cannot hear, because they do not deserve to, because it would be dangerous if they knew, because in that time it was not safe to sing a song of freedom without subterfuge. In the reading this morning from Sarah Hopkins Bradford's retelling of that legend and life of Harriet Tubman, we heard about a goodbye sung into open windows and hummed into the ears of the masters. Her farewell was an open secret, open to those who needed to hear, quite closed to those who did not. And she sang it over and over again that day, preparing for her long flight to freedom. Her friends heard one thing in the repeated strains, "I'm gonna leave you. Farewell, oh farewell, I'm bound for the promised land, I'm gonna leave you." And her captors heard another thing entirely. Her friends heard that their bondage was limited, that in fact for her it was over tomorrow, that the jig was up. And her owners heard a little black woman singing a song. That little black woman was singing. And her words were so powerful that they catapulted her and so many others to the freedom that waited just on the other side. She was more powerful than the doctor or any of her captors. She was, in fact, more powerful than any of the men who worked the fields with her. She was more powerful than anyone in that place, and only those with eyes to see saw the truth, and only those with ears to hear heard what she had to tell them. That tool of a musical subterfuge that Tubman used in her escape, it wasn't limited to her. She didn't invent it or even pioneer it. She was a part of a phenomenon that was alive and useful for many decades in her community. The use of spirituals as coded communication was born out of necessity. It piled multiple layers of meaning on top of one another to serve multiple purposes for many audiences. Different songs served different functions. Some, like Harriet Tubman's, were mostly farewells, meant to indicate in a general sense that escape was imminent. Other songs were mostly liturgical. They were used in worship and in praise to give the people hope. Still, other songs could not have been more specific. They functioned as maps that led the way out. There's a legend in Underground Railroad history that says that there was a free black man with one leg who was conveniently named Peg Leg Joe, who would hire himself out to different plantations, and when Joe got to each new place, he would form relationships with the slave and he would set about teaching them the song, "Follow the Drinking Gourd." Follow the drinking gourd, it said, to the big river when the sun comes back. The drinking gourd was none other than the Big Dipper, which pointed the way each and every night toward the North Star, which pointed the way to freedom. Follow the drinking gourd to the big river, the Ohio, when the sun comes back in the spring, and there will be people to ferry you across. That song literally pointed the way. It gave a concrete plan. Where, when, how. It reminded the people that even if they were utterly lost, they could just look up, find the drinking gourd, and keep walking north. Some legends say that "Swing Low, Sweet Chariot" is itself a map song, pointing the way to a specific station along the Underground Railroad. We don't know for sure, but we do know that that song, with its sweet, deep, low melody, rang out over the prayer circles and the church gatherings of the enslaved peoples. offering a reminder that home was not impossibly distant, but attainable both spiritually and for some literally too. The chariot descends from above, driven by God or by the conductors of the Underground Railroad. It descends and it carries the people home to heaven, to freedom, to Africa, to the blessed company of those who have already crossed over. And when the people sang those words, they found a way to carry on. They found a way to resist. And sometimes when resistance wasn't enough to fight the powers of oppression, that song gave them the strength to let go with grace and with dignity. And the owners heard those words ringing out over the fields and they thought, isn't that nice? The slaves are singing. And they did not know what their own ears heard. But in 1963, at the foot of the Lincoln Memorial, when Mahalia Jackson stood up before Martin Luther King rose to speak about his dreams, she opened that glorious voice of hers and sang, "How I got over, how did I make it over? You know, my soul looked back and wonder, how did I make it over?" And not a person in that crowd, not a person in this country listened to her singing and thought, how nice. In fact, not a person in this country had any doubt whatsoever just what Miss Jackson was referring to when she said she had crossed over. Freedom was no longer a matter of subterfuge. It was becoming, is still becoming, a literal truth, unavoidable even to the eyes and the ears of the oppressor. The freedom songs of the civil rights era were, in many cases, the very same spirituals that guided the feet and nurtured the spirits of the slaves making their way out of bondage. But in 1963, there was no more time for code words. The people had to hear and they had to understand the full, many-layered depth of the message from those rich texts of the slave spiritual. Civil rights leaders found a new music for a new time. The old forms were mixed with the new, and every single musical moment in the civil rights era existed so that the people could express their power to everyone, especially those who persisted in maintaining the systems of oppression. I've been thinking about that a lot this week. After being in a generally dismal state of mind about the state of our society and our culture last week, I've been thinking about what it says when a group of people can take a song that once was not safe for the oppressor to hear and turn it on its head so that it becomes a message aimed directly at the oppressor. What happens, and what does it say about a culture when the code is shattered and the message becomes utterly unavoidable? What does it say when finally the songs can be sung in the street, not in spite of, but because of their deepest meanings? It says that the society has a chance and that the oppressor no longer is quite as powerful, and that the people do not have to fear the implications of their message. In 1963, Martin Luther King could speak his dream and know that the people were listening. Know that even though he may die, his message wouldn't. The fact that he could speak his dream and Mahalia Jackson could sing her songs, all aimed directly at the people who would deny them their freedoms, it meant something to this nation. It meant that we had a chance, not even a likelihood perhaps, but a chance of overcoming the very worst of ourselves together. But not every dream has an audience like Dr. King's did then. Not every song can be sung in the streets with the full clarity of its message. Some songs are still whispered in the dark. Some words of power are still fundamentally unheard or not understood or simply forgotten or blatantly ignored. The masters of the old plantations had ears, but they could not hear. They had eyes, but they could not see. There was truth that was not available to them because their actions gave them only one layer of the story, when most of the power and the challenge and the wisdom lay down deep in a place they could not reach. In Matthew 13, Jesus had this to say of the people who would not address the suffering of their neighbors. "For this people's heart has become calloused. They hardly hear with their ears, and they have closed their eyes." What am I not listening to? What am I not hearing? What voices in this society are dulled to a hum in the background because we are not willing to hear them? What would happen if I opened my ears? What would I hear? What would you hear? How might the song we refuse to listen to transform us? In one of my favorite books, Heidi Newmark tells the story of a little church in the South Bronx that she served in the mid-80s. This was a time when the South Bronx resembled nothing so much as a post-apocalyptic nightmare, crisscrossed by highway overpasses that kept the people of means safely separated from the people in pain. The rich folks drove by on the highways, and the poor kids hung out in the streets. It was, she said, ground zero for urban blight. It was a place where it was not uncommon for mothers to scrub the blood of their dead sons off the street before passing traffic trampled and desecrated that holy ground. It was a time of drugs and AIDS and death, and Newmark writes that there was never a night without gunfire or a week without funerals. And for some years in that community, it seemed as if nobody heard and nobody cared. And there they were, this little church, trying to exist in a war zone that nobody paid attention to. There they were, trying to make enough noise that someone might finally notice. And they started little by little to do the work of the church. They stopped being so afraid, and they opened their doors. They got engaged in their community. They took care of each other. And one of the first organized activities that this little church started was a summer program where the local kids came ready and eager to have something safe to do together, away from the blight of the streets and the fear and the loss. One day, this program, this summer program, included a field trip to a parking lot, which had been decorated with scenes from the Bible. A blue strip down the middle of the pavement was the River Jordan. A papier-mâché Ark of the Covenant stood ready to be borne on little shoulders. And an SUV draped in paper stood in for the walls of Jericho. Some of you know the story of the walls of Jericho. The Hebrew people approached the seemingly impenetrable walls, outnumbered and facing enormous obstacles. They walked around the gates of the city 7 times. Then Joshua blew his mighty trumpet, and the sound was so great that the walls came tumbling down. Well, in this parking lot, Jericho, the children whom nobody listened to, those whose struggles and hurts and hopes existed just below the consciousness of the powerful, this band of outnumbered people facing impenetrable obstacles, circled the walls of their vehicular Jericho 7 times, stepping quietly together, not making a sound until they completed their rounds. And not having a trumpet, they shouted out the loudest song they knew. In their loudest voices, they sang out, "I said a boom, chicka boom." I'm going to need your help. Anybody go to summer camp? You're going to be able to help me out here. Ready? I said a boom, chicka boom. I said a boom, chicka rocka, chicka rocka, chicka boom. I don't think we'd take down the walls of Jericho, but it's not bad. When those children did it, the paper walls fell down flat before their great power. No longer silent, in that moment, no longer unheard, their voices echoed over the potholes and the empty lots and the city hall. And it didn't work magic, but good things happened for them. Isn't that nice? The children are singing. Isn't that nice? That's what some ears might hear. But those little voices were shouting something deeper and more elemental than that. They were shouting because in that moment, finally, both literally and metaphorically, someone was listening. Their silly words had serious meaning. We are not finished yet. You cannot write us off. That's what they sang. The meaning under their words, the code that they and anyone willing to could hear. We are not finished yet, and this society does not have permission to give up on us. At least their church had ears to hear. And their voices and their eyes saw the pain and spoke it. And while never enough, maybe that was a start. As the hymn we'll conclude our service with today says, they were singing for their lives, and somebody finally noticed. In singing the great spirituals proudly, within the context of hoped-for freedom, Martin Luther King and the civil rights leaders who followed him told our society that now at least it is safe enough to sing the songs and try to understand. Now at least this whole society has the option to listen to all levels of meaning if we are brave enough to do it. Now at least we can open our ears if we are willing to face down the full meaning of songs of hope and freedom and challenge. This does not mean that the people will listen. This does not mean that the oppressed will be heard. It means that now, in a post-Martin Luther King and Mahalia Jackson world, it is our own damn fault if we hear and we do not understand. We live in a world that follows the work of these brave ones, of the civil rights leaders, who remind us that we no longer have permission to hear "Swing Low, Sweet Chariot" and think, "Well, isn't that nice?" We must hear it, and we must understand that freedom is not fully won when people continue to be judged solely on the melanin content of their skin, and when whole communities and neighborhoods and even nations are left at the mercy of economic forces they cannot control, and nobody hears the voices of their people. We may be freedom bound, but the work's not done. And that song will never be just a lovely old tune again. Just like Dr. King's words can never be just a nice little bit of inspiration to pick up when we feel like a happier day. That song, and all the songs of oppressed peoples, must be challenges to all of us. To live out a new radical message in our day and tell this world that we're leaving this particular brokenness behind. Step by step, and we must carry one another home. May it be so, and amen.